Welcome to Spiritually Raw. We expose and explore controversial truths, myths, and theories surrounding the spirit world. Guests include QAnon experts, investigators, debunkers, and skeptics of the supernatural, unexplained, and flat-out unimaginable. Content discussed on this show is not necessarily the opinion of the cast of Spiritually Raw, and topics quite often are for mature audiences only. This show is not intended to replace any medical, financial, or legal advice, and is for entertainment purposes only. So sit back, relax, and enjoy the ride. Hello, everybody. How are you? And welcome to Spiritually Raw. We hope you woke to the most miracle morning and are also having the most fortunate day today. Thank you very much for your energy exchange with us today. We got a really cool guest. This is like we were just talking about, like a reunion tour, because we're actually getting connected with a lot of the guests that we first interviewed when the show started nearly 10 years ago. Now it did. So who you're seeing right there is Master Wizard Oberon Zell, the headmaster of the Gray School of Wizardry, which April's going to tell you about more in just a little bit. I do want to remind you and thank you for hitting the subscribe button and turning on the notification bell. And also to, again, Mind, Body, Spirit Reset. Visiting our friends at hempworks.com really seems to be making a lot of difference with so many people. So, again, we encourage you to do that if you haven't already. So, thank you.
I mean, did you see the chalice? You have all the parts. Like, I mean, you
best.
Are who you say you are through and through.
This is the best.
No, yeah, what else should I do?
I love it.
Just wait for the unicorn to come through, everybody.
Exactly. We're not joking either.
Yes. So, why don't you share with us?
Yeah, okay. So, let me tell you a little bit about Oberon.
Master Wizard Oberon
Zell. Yes, he's a modern Renaissance man. He's a transpersonal psychologist, metaphysician, naturalist, theologian. I mean, I could just go on and on and on. I'm going to shorten into like just the first top 10 things he does. Shaman, author, ordained priest of the Earth of Mother Gaia. Among and many other projects he's undertaken in his lifetime, Oberon is one of the founders of the Church of All Worlds. He is the first publisher. Do y'all remember this? The Green Egg Magazine. If you've been in like the spiritual realm for a while, you remember the Green Egg Magazine. And the headmaster of the Gray School of Wizardry. He is the founder and curator of the Academy of Arcana. Those who know him well consider him to be a true wizard in the traditional sense. And
right on. So
I'm not going to lie. That's a true statement.
Yeah, join me, everybody, in welcoming Master Wizard Oberon Zell to the show. Very, very great to have you on here. Thank you very much for being here.
I have to ask you this. Thank you. We're so excited. Last time you were on the show, you had talked about, you were also, and I didn't put it on here, that you actually made a unicorn. You were like the originator, the first person that actually created a unicorn. And is that still true?
In modern times, yes. Well, yes, that was in modern times, of course. In ancient times, unicorns had been created, and the secret had been discovered and lost several times throughout history. And when they appeared, it was a big deal, and then they disappeared, and everybody forgot. And I rediscovered the secret in the late 1970s, mid-1970s, and my beloved life mate, Morning Glory, and I decided that, well, it would make a great chapter in the book we were writing, but it would be even more interesting if we could actually see if it worked, and it did. So we created the first living unicorns in hundreds of years, and that was all we did in the 1980s. The first ones were born in the spring of 1980, and they were all over the place. We attended every single Renaissance fair in North America during that
period. I remember
it
in the news
and eventually
our
it was huge. Then our agent got us a 4-year exhibition contract with the Ringling Brothers Barnum and Bailey Circus, and they made it a huge event worldwide. And now, like 40 years later, the world has completely forgotten that this ever happened. And if you ask people about unicorns today, they say, oh, that's just an imaginary mythical beast. And it's remarkable how this happens. Here we have this thing that is huge, phenomenon, everybody's excited about it, and then it just vanishes from the collective consciousness and everybody forgets. Wow.
Yeah, it is a big wow
category.
True. Would you bring it, would you at this point in your life take that on again to resuscitate the whole phenomenon?
Well, I think at this point in my life, and without my partner and not living in the country anymore, where we really had the facilities to do that, it would be extremely difficult. But I'm certainly willing to pass on the information to the next generation. I've written up a detailed description of the whole process and everything that's involved, and I've made it available to a few people who inquired and said that they would like to do this. And if somebody does, that would be neat, you know, it'll be back again. But traditionally, there's been centuries in between the appearances of unicorns. So I don't know whether it's going to happen again soon or not. But I just don't see that myself in this phase of my life, I'm going to be able to do that again. Like I said, it's all we did in the 80s. And I have other things to do with the remainder of the time I still have on.
Awesome.
What did you, when you decided to become, or what was the thought process and said, okay, I'm going to now become an official public viewed wizard. When did that happen for you?
Well, that actually, interestingly enough, happened along with the unicorn thing. I mean, I've always been, for all my whole life, deeply interested and obsessed, really, about mythology and magic and arcane lore and all that stuff. So I really had the background for it. But I never actually claimed it exactly. Being a wizard is not something that you come up and say, I'm a wizard. It's something that other people say, he's a wizard. You know, it's kind of the way it works, you know. So, but when we had the unicorns and we decided that we wanted to take them out into the world, the question was, what would be the appropriate venue? And initially, we adopted the persona of naturalist because there's no credentials required. If you try to say you're a scientist, then people will argue and they'll say, oh, no, you're a pseudoscientist because you don't work for some big, you know, company or industry or something like that. You're not getting grants. So that's what you have to be a scientist. But to be a naturalist, you don't. So that worked out okay. And for our first little time, that's how we presented ourselves. And that was fine, no arguments there. But then we decided that the best venue would be the Renaissance Fairs. And we had Renaissance Fairs asking us to come and bring a unicorn to them. It was a whole symbol. So then it became the question, well, what is the persona? Because when you do a Ren Fair, you have to have a costume and a persona. You don't just show up in street clothes, you know, and blue jeans and T-shirts.
Right.
So what would be the appropriate one? Well, it seemed like the obvious identity to adopt for the Renaissance Fair would be the wizard and the enchantress. So Morning Glory was the enchantress and I was the wizard, and we went out and everybody totally accepted that. You know, you put on the pointy hat and there you are. And then it kind of became, you know, you start off with a role or a persona, and before long you inhabit it. And that was 40 years ago, and it's still going.
Day to day, or do you wear the attire that a wizard wears, that traditionally how people would envision a wizard and drink out of the chalice like you just did? Is that a day to day?
Well, drinking out of the chalice is, but the rest of the whole persona, outfit, costume, pointy hat, staff, and all that stuff is for occasions. You know, it's like, you know, that's the uniform. That's the superhero suit. That's the that's the uniform you wear when you're on duty. And well, I suppose I could have worn that for this occasion, but
next
it didn't
one,
seem like
next
it was
one.
Quite that for me.
Next time.
Yeah.
So happy to do it. Thank you. The unicorn, you said you discovered the secret. How did you discover it? Was it something you found in a book? Was it something you meditated on?
Well, we were doing research for a book. Give me just a second and I'll get you the book.
Okay, cool. Show and tell everybody.
Wizard, everybody.
And he really did make unicorns. You can look it up.
This is the book.
Like you bred them, right?
We decided, Morning Glory and I were both fascinated by mythology and ancient lore and all that kind of stuff. And especially mysterious, legendary, mythical animals, all sorts, whether it was unicorns or dragons or Loch Ness Monster or Bigfoot, whatever. And we were quite interested in that. We read everything we could get our hands on. And at some point, we decided that, you know, with all these stories, there's usually some truth behind the story, something that stimulated the story, some grain of sand at the heart of the pearl, you know. And wouldn't it be neat to write a book about that? What with all these different critters. So we started doing research. And at that time, we hit the road. We were traveling around. We fixed up an old school bus and started traveling around the country and visiting libraries and universities. This is before there was Wikipedia, you know, and the internet.
Right.
Now it's so easy to do research. But in those days, you had to go to libraries and look stuff up. And we collected all kinds of stuff, and I made Xeroxes of articles and images and pictures of all kinds of things, and found out some really amazing stuff to flesh out the book. And in the process, we came upon The Secret of the Unicorn, which blew us away because we had just assumed, as most people do, that the mythology of the unicorn was based on rhinoceroses, although that's mm-hmm. not really how they're depicted in the images. They're always depicted as these small hoofed animals that can small enough to lie their head in a maiden's lap with, you know, cloven hooves and white
and rainbows
and all that stuff. Well, they weren't. No, the rainbows were never a part of the imagery, nor were the horses ever a part of the imagery. That's another interesting thing. But they were always depicted as cloven hoofed animals with a beard. And the beard is a key because there's only one kind of hoofed animals that have a beard, and those are goats. And as we started collecting these images, we discovered that at various times in history, there were different horned animals that you could see were the prototype. I mean, the earliest ones were taurine, bull unicorns, and they were massive bulls with a single horn, and they're depicted fighting lions 4,000 years ago all over the place. And then in ancient Greece, they were rams, and they were clearly, you know, a sheep ram. But they were, again, mightier and more magnificent than the usual variety. And then there's antelopine, and in the Orient, there's deer unicorns, the Kielin, the Kyrian. And we found these all throughout history, and they were clearly identifiable what the species was that they were derived from. The thing that made them unicorns was having a single horn growing from the center of their forehead. Not one missing one that there was grown off to the side, but one single central straight horn. And they all had that. And so, and then we came upon some references from various places to the idea that they were actually created. This was an art form, you know, like oh, bonsai wow. is an art form. And but the secret of how to do this had been mysterious. It had been protected and secretive and guarded, and it had been lost and rediscovered numerous times. And we figured it out. We figured out, wow, well, you know, the whole thing is based on one little simple piece of information that people were not generally aware of, and that is that when baby horned animals are born, they don't have horns, obviously, because then that would be kind of rough in the birthing process, as you can imagine. Instead, what they have is in the forehead, there are little nodes that they call horn buds that are glands. And the function of these is that within a day or so after birth, these glands secrete enzymes. And the enzymes go down into the skull, and they stimulate the development of the horn structure. But they're loose in the early baby. You know, the skin on the forehead is loose and movable. And the idea is, if you can find a way to artfully bring those two separate buds together and unite them in the center, then all the enzymes will be one single batch instead of two batches. And a single horn will grow, and instead of being curved, the curve will be canceled out by the fact that it's all in one place, and a single horn grows. And the only place they can come together is right smack in the middle of the forehead, where mm-hmm. six different bones come together. There's the two frontal bones, the orbital superorbital bones, the suborbital bones, and the nasal bones all come together at the point we call the third eye. So all of this, we figured out the And then we said, well, let's try it. And we did, and it worked. And the first living unicorns came into the world in hundreds of years.
What was the
that's just it was absolutely amazing.
Was it mated with something? Did you have to crossbreed it of any sort? Like any animal, or they were just how they are? Process.
Well, we had to find the right breeding stock that matched the tapestries. We figured that what we really wanted to do is to create the animal that is depicted in those classic tapestries from the Renaissance period, of which there are two beautiful sets, one in New York and one in France, that are very famous, the Hunt of the Unicorn and the Five Senses images of the unicorn. And you know, so that's what we were shooting for. So we spent a lot of time going around the country and looking at different suppliers of goats, because we knew it had to be goats, because all the rest of the features matched, and of course, telltale beard. But there, but that particular breed of goats that we see in the pictures doesn't quite match any of the ones that you see around today, because they've been bred further. So we had to find the right stock, and we looked at large herds of hundreds of animals and selected the ones that matched most closely. And we did a little crossbreeding with Angora and Angora and Sonnen. We tried different breeds to get the right ones, and we did. We got exactly the right one. It's a perfect match. And then
we brought them out, we would
have a big replica of the tapestry. How long is the process?
The actual
procedure has to be done within a day of birth. So that's pretty critical. You have to have the pregnant doe, and you have to be right there when the baby's born. The actual procedure takes maybe an hour or so, but then there's a long period of nurturance and care. For example, they're incredibly dangerous. So you can't just let them grow up with the rest of the herd. So we had to sleep with them and raise them and domesticate them and keep them in the house as household pets, which meant we had to housebreak them and teach them how to live like a dog would be in the house, you know, house animal.
So your whole life literally revolved around.
Like I said, that's all we did in the 80s. That was whole life.
What were their mannerisms like? Are they like a dog? Are they similar like a household pet that you would envision? Do they listen to you?
Well, yeah, they were very intelligent. They were highly intelligent, because one of the interesting things is that when the two horns grow separately, they form a thickening of the skull underneath that area called the boss that compresses the brain in the frontal lobes. So most horned animals are kind of dumb, especially the males, because they're the ones with the big horns generally. And but that's not the case with the unicorn. And since the horn grows from the center, it's hollow. The sinuses grow up into the horn, and therefore they vastly increase the sense of smell, but they don't compress the brain. So the animals are highly intelligent, about as intelligent as a dog, and they also have an incredible sense of smell and other features. And of course, since the horn grows out from the front, the balance of weight on the neck and everything is different, because the normal skull of a horned animal balances, it pivots on the axis at the top of the neck, you know, but it's all balanced that way. The horns go back and then the skull goes in front. With the unicorn, all the weight is to the front, which means that the neck has to grow much thicker and more muscular to support it. And then the shoulders go bigger too. So the animals don't look like their parents. They're not like scrawny neck, you know, thin shoulder. They're magnificent, powerful neck and powerful shoulders. Features that we often see in horses, Faye, which is why that many people have made that association, because they don't look like goats or whatever, you know, they're more magnificent. And so, you know, there's so many things though. We found that almost all of the things that were said in the stories had a validity to them. For example, one of the lore of the unicorn is that their horn was proof against poison, that it would, if you had a drinking horn made of unicorn horn, it would deactivate poison. Well, it turns out that this is actually true. The keratin of a horn, an ordinary drinking horn will do this, will absorb the arsenic compounds out of any liquid. The irony is, of course, that in the Middle Ages and the Renaissance time when people were doing this, they weren't selling actual unicorn horns. They were selling narwhal tusks, which are made of ivory and don't do any good at all. I'm afraid. So there's so many aspects of the story, though. There really are. The bit about the maidens, for example.
What's that?
Go ahead.
I'll just answer this real quick, though. Did the unicorn horn, because it was put, I mean, it would grow literally around, if not on their third eye, very close to it. Do you think that had anything else about their intelligence?
I think so. I do. We associate that particular region, which is above the pineal gland behind it, is also a key seat in psychic type stuff. The pineal gland governs a lot of aspects of our existence. It governs our circadian rhythms with melatonin. It governs, well, it's associated with lots of psychic kind of stuff. So it was like these guys had a magic wand growing out of their third eye. And I think that that also contributed to their intelligence and their intuition and their perception. They were really quite remarkable animals. They really were. Not like anything else, really.
Yeah, that's true.
You would think
that's
not. I want to moving right along here with you on to get to know you more. Can you tell us what a wizard, as far as faith, belief system, what is your practicing belief system that you subscribe to, that you live by?
Well, wizardry is not a belief system. It's not a profession of faith. And being a wizard is like being a professor or a doctor or a teacher, that kind of a thing. It doesn't define your faith or your belief. But it generally, wizards generally tend to have a very broad perspective on such matters because they generally acquire knowledge from many, many different sources. The founders of all the world's great religions would qualify as wizards, certainly, you know, Jesus, Buddha, Muhammad, Zoroaster, Confucius, Lao Tzu. All of these figures that founded great religions would qualify as wizards by the nature of it. But the wizard's main job is being a mentor to the next generation, of being a teacher. Really, the analog today, the best analog, is professor. But we use the term accurately to refer to like computer wizards or financial wizards or other kind of people who know a lot of stuff. Mm-hmm. We use it for that way. So being a wizard means you got to know stuff that most people don't know. So people come to you for advice and counsel, which is the main job. Wizards have been counselors and advisors for kings and emperors and pharaohs. The first recorded wizard who we have a lot of details about was Imhotep in ancient Egypt, who served as the advisor for three consecutive pharaohs and was credited with inventing the first pyramid, the step pyramid, and all of the systems of medicine and astrology and mathematics. These were recorded in books. Many of the books, the textbooks of ancient times, were written by wizards. These were passed down. So that's a part of what wizards have done, is writing the books. And these books are usually called grimoires, from which we get our term grammar, as in a grammar is a textbook. It used to be an old name for textbook. So the books written by wizards are textbooks of knowledge, of wisdom, divination, mathematics, architecture, medicine, all these things.
It sounds like a prophet.
So it's a pretty cool gig.
It's awesome.
Sounds like, you know, listen, God, whatever you believe in, bless you for living your life, really. Yeah. It's really quite an admiration. It sounds like you're having a great time.
So is a wizard then, have they also hijacked it or changed it and also used or call it a prophet?
I think so. The thing about prophecy is that the best way to predict the future is to create it. And generally throughout history, and there are many, many examples. I mean, if you look at some of the famous figures in history, you can pick out people like Leonardo da Vinci, Benjamin Franklin, Nikola Tesla. You know, many great figures that have made a huge impact in the world have been called wizards in their time. Thomas Edison was called the Wizard of Menlo Park. That was his official designation. And so by shaping the future and envisioning it, Nikola Tesla predicted in some detail in 1926, he predicted the cell phone. He wrote a detailed description of what this would mean and what it would be like. And you get that all throughout history, these people. I mean, look at the stuff that Leonardo da Vinci conceived of. I mean, it's famous for that, you know. Mm-hmm. So wizards have acquired the reputation as prophets, primarily because their visions and their work changes the world, shapes the future. So, you know, there's that aspect of it. And I've had my share of that, I think.
No question about it.
Does if you take a look at like paganism, does that actually, when you look at it or people read up on it, does that accurately describe wizardry when you look at it from that? Or do they do it? Does that way of life, if you would, does it do a good job of representing what a wizard is?
Well, I think it does. I think if you look at the current religious models that are going around, paganism comes closest to assimilating the ancient traditions and ancient lore. It's kind of, that's what it is. Paganism is basically a revival of the ancient pre-Christian, pre-monotheistic traditions. And they very much have a place for wizards. You know, the Druids of ancient times were wizards. You know, that was, Merlin was a wizard. I mean, he was a Druid. He was a, you know, so I find myself as a pagan that my religious orientation and conviction fits very well my model of wizardry. But I have known people, there are people in my circle of wizards, you know, who profess other faiths as well. And that's okay because we all tend to get along. I think shamanism is a good key for that. I've been all over the world and I've had the opportunity to sit down with traditional shamans in many different cultures. And we recognize each other immediately as peers. So wizards and shamans are pretty much the same thing. And we're totally on board with the same stuff. We can sit there and have these great conversations and laugh our asses off and get drunk together, and it's all fine. There's no conflict in that. Whereas the rest of the people in the village may not be fully on top of all this stuff, you know? Mm-hmm. It's like if you go to Asia, everybody's Buddhist, for example, in many countries, but they don't know any of this stuff. They just will burn incense in front of a statue of the Buddha and ask for goodies, but they don't have any concept what the philosophy and teachings are because they don't need to. And the same thing for many Christians today. The Bible just sits on a coffee table. Nobody actually reads it, you know, for many of these people. They're not priests and clergy of their religion. But the Druids were the priests and clergy of the ancient pagan villages. And so there's that function. So as a wizard, part of my function is being able to do rituals and perform rites of passage and counseling and such as people require.
And then what does your day look like? Like you wake up in the morning, do you have a certain ritual? What do you do? What's a day in the life of a wizard Oberon Zell?
Well, I don't know if it's all that dramatic. I mean, the first thing I do is make breakfast, and then I sit down and check my email and messages and spend most of my morning responding to messages coming in email and Facebook and phone and text and so many of these things that requires a good part of my time, and people are constantly asking me about stuff, so I have to answer all these things. I generally check my class lists at the school. I've got a couple of classes that I teach there, but, you know, I do not teach that many. I mean, we have over 600 classes in the Gray School, and I only teach a couple of them just to keep my hand in. But we have a large staff of faculty. It's a whole school. So I do that. So I check to see if I've got new assignments that I have to.
Is it a physical school or is it an online school?
It's online, which has served us very well during this pandemic because nobody could be going to a physical school, which we couldn't really afford to maintain anyway. If we were trying to maintain a physical school, people would have to go there and we'd have to put them up and feed them and house them and all that. And they would have to pay an extraordinary amount of money to be able to support all that, which we're not charging. But this is perfect because it's kind of like the school exists in a magical realm, you know, online. We even have a virtual campus in Second Life. It's got the whole castle and stone circles and all that kind of cool stuff, too. So it works out very well, and I'm really very pleased with it. Check out the Gray School.
Oh, I'm sure they will. For sure. So do you think that if we can paint a picture of what the school teaches, if you look at a movie like Harry Potter, I mean, is that an accurate description or how far off was that what you're actually teaching in the school?
Well, I think some of the subjects that were mentioned in the Harry Potter, which is entirely a fictional story, it really doesn't get into the philosophy and teachings of wizardry. It's a setting for kids coming of age in school kind of thing. It just puts it in a more of a fantasy place, which is marvelous. I love that stuff. We all do. You know, many stories of wizardry, fiction stories, involve a school where the young wizards go to learn the stuff, you know, and they're taught by the older, wise wizards. That's a common thing. And in fact, it still applies. The traditional costumes of professors that we see at graduation ceremonies are the same as the traditional costumes of associated with wizards, because the university system grew out of the mystery schools of ancient times. Like I said, a professor is really the best modern analog for wizard. But that's the subjects, we have 16 departments, and they encompass the departments in the Grey School encompass healing and divination and natural philosophy and alchemy, herbology, cosmology, math magics, and of course there's a department of dark arts that's all the spooky stuff, you know. So we have a lot of that, and some of these things do parallel what's shown in the Harry Potter stories, because they drew from J.K. Rowling, you know, obviously done some homework. She drew from the mythos, and the mythos is based on the reality.
What do you think is the biggest misconception about paganism?
Well, I think the biggest totally misconception is that somehow paganism is about worshiping the devil or some, you know, negativity and stuff, which is ridiculous, of course, because it's all about nature. Paganism, the best way to, I think, describe paganism is to say it's green religion. Like we have green politics and green economics and green technology. Paganism is green religion. It's all about nature. It's about the earth. The primary divinity concept is Mother Earth, you know, Gaia herself, you know, as in this little statue that I made here. So the Gaia thesis, the idea that the entire biosphere of Earth is one single vast living organism, is kind of foundation of the pagan premise. Mother Earth is the oldest and most universal concept of theology. Everybody, everywhere in the world knows about Mother Earth. You talk about that, you don't have to explain it. And have forever, we have images, the same images and concepts go back to the dawn of time. In the Middle Ages, they called her Anima Mundi, the spirit of the earth, you know? And so there's that.
You have I'm looking at some of the notes here. You mentioned something about the year the earth stood still. Can you help us understand what you mean by that?
Sure, I'm delighted to. Some of you may remember an old science fiction movie that came out in, I believe, 1954 or six, somewhere in the mid-50s, called The Day the Earth Stood Still. And in that story, an alien emissary stops all electricity in the world for like an hour at noon. And this is a lesson to the world that, you know, that their power is greater than our own. And the message is you guys clean up the act here. You're really screwing up the world. And if you don't do that, then the grown-ups are going to come in and clean up the mess for you. So, you know, here's your choice. And that was the theme of the movie. Very good movie, actually. One of the best. And in this past year with the COVID, at the dawn of the 2020s, and I'll have to say something about the significance of the 2020s to make sense of this, we've been basically stopped. The world has been just halted from so many ways. And the thing is that there's this concept in the stories of the hero's quest, of the great adventures. And that is, before the morning going off on the quest, there's usually the night before is a time of vigil, reflection, when you know, you may fast, you may undergo a period of celibacy, you go into contemplation, you may go and pray in the chapel, but you basically kind of, you know, before you set off, you think about it really carefully, what you're about to do. And I think that the whole world has been subjected to a little bit of a timeout period here to consider what comes next. And one aspect. Another aspect is, another aspect I should mention, though, is that from the perspective of Gaia, from Mother Earth, we can see plagues and viruses as her antibody system, her immune system kicking in. Because when an organs in our body go nuts and the cells start reproducing out of all reason and it throwing things out of balance and dumping toxins in the systems, that's what we call a cancer. And this is what, to a great extent, humanity is doing within the greater body of our living planet. We've become cancerous. And the response to cancer that happens in an organism is to respond with antibodies to try to, you know, kill it off, to cut it back. So I think we need to look at that. If we really perceive the comprehension that we are part of a larger organism, we're not just individual entities running around here like individual cells in our body, we're part of that greater body, then that's a good context, I think. Now, the significance of this time is this, that for at least 400 years, maybe longer, maybe 600 years actually, since the 1480s, the Italian Renaissance, every 60 years, like clockwork, there's been a cultural renaissance. The Italian Renaissance of the 1480s, the Reformation of the 1540s and the Age of Exploration, the Golden Age of the English Renaissance in 1600, and the Scientific Revolution in the 1660s, the Great Awakening in the 1720s, the Age of Reason, the French and American Revolutions of the 1780s, the Transcendentalist Awakening of the 1840s, the Golden Dawn at the turn of the century, after the 20th century, and of course the New Age, the psychedelic 60s. All of these on a 60-year cycle, bang, 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 and they have been times of transformation. If we look back at what occurred just in the 1960s, all of the movements that have shaped the world since, you know, the sexual freedom, free speech, women's liberation, gay rights, civil rights, the psychedelic revolution, and of course the pagan movement. All of these emerged in the 60s and they were transformative, and the echoes of them are still shaping the world. And now mm-hmm. we're about to enter into a new one. And so I think we have the concept of 2020 hindsight, and I think that now we're in a position to have a 2020 foresight. And if we take the what I said before about prophecy being shaping the future rather than just predicting it, well, the question now is, what kind of future do we want to shape? What do we want to have come forth? And if we collectively start envisioning the world we actually want to have, not what we fear, but what we hope, you know, not what we're afraid of, but what we are drawn to, we will shape this coming era the same way that the previous eras have been shaped in these same times. And we've got off to a great start. We've been kind of given this time out to think about it, you know.
Definitely true from the timeout point perspective, absolutely. You had mentioned a Great Awakening, I think it was like in the 1700s, and they're also terming this era now as the Great Awakening. Is there a reason for that?
Yes, there is. And interestingly enough, I myself, in about 20 years ago, started writing about this and predicting, in fact, that this next period of time would be called the Awakening. And I'm quite delighted to see that language has in fact become the descriptive language, because as far as I know, I'm the first person to have articulated. In fact, as far as I know, I'm the first person to have actually noticed the 60-year cycle, although more people are now picking up on it and you're seeing it everywhere. But I believe that my writings on that 20 years ago and calling this coming one the Great Awakening were unprecedented by anybody else. So what I see this meaning is an awakening of consciousness, not only personally, but on a global scale, a planetary consciousness. After all, every living organism, no matter how simple, has its own consciousness, its own awareness. And if we're looking at a living organism the size of a planet, well, it also has to have its own consciousness and awareness. And so I believe that a global consciousness, a global brain, as Nikola Tesla said, a global awareness, a global consciousness, is emerging out of this entire process of our evolution. We are becoming more conscious, and that spreads and grows, because consciousness is the antithesis of entropy. It's anti-entropy. Entropy means everything kind of falls apart, deteriorates, but throughout the history of the planet and the cosmos, really, we have seen, in opposition to entropy, we've seen the emergence of life mm-hmm. growing and spreading, and consciousness growing. That's anti-entropic. That reverses entropy. And I think we're going to just see that as an inevitable part of it. Eventually, our consciousness will become planetary. As we extend out into space, we will be developing a cosmic consciousness, presumably, eventually, linking up with other developing cultures and species from other worlds also, and that the whole cosmos is moving towards consciousness, that that's the point of evolution itself, is increasing consciousness, just as we ourselves, when we start off as embryo, you know, eventually we become human, we become conscious. The what we call evolution, I think, is embryology on a planetary scale. But it doesn't just stop here with this planet. It just keeps going.
And how long do you think this cycle will last, the cosmic consciousness cycle?
Well, I don't see there's really an end to it, but I also, if I'm doing predictions and working to shape them, the next 60-year cycle will be the 2080s. And I've been calling that the Gaiaspora, because that's the time that I really feel that humanity will be spreading out of this one single planet and into the other worlds of our solar system and beyond. So, and at that point, the consciousness will be leaping to another level, just as dramatic as when our distant ancestors came out of the seas, you know, 200 million years ago, you know, and came up onto land. We're at that threshold as well.
Wow.
So as we do that, that will set up new cycles and new emergences will occur. Mm-hmm. And it's a perpetual process. It doesn't end. It's like saying, if you plant a seed, then is that the end of the whole thing? The tree grows up and that's it? No, because the tree grows up and plants more seeds, and a forest grows up, and the forest becomes an ecosystem, and it just keeps on going.
You mentioned earlier about the fact that prophecy could help us shape, you know, shape our future, I guess, if I'm paraphrasing that properly there for you. Does that take out the fact that there's a destiny in play here, that there is an end goal, or can we, is there no such thing as destiny from that thought process?
Well, I don't see any reason for it to be an either or. For example, when conception occurs with a human being, there's an inevitable process of the development of an embryo, you know, that's built in. You could say that's the destiny. The DNA, you know, does its thing, and a being develops, and, you know, limbs and stuff appear, and all the rest of the stuff occurs. When you plant a seed, out of that tiny little seed that just looks like a little itty-bitty thing, an entire tree will grow out of that, and the same kind of tree will grow out of every seed, but no two trees are going to be alike. They're not going to look exactly alike. They're not going to have the same branches. No two people are going to be exactly alike, even though they all start with that conception of a sperm and an egg. So that's where the destiny occurs. There's a certain inevitability of the unfolding of the process that we are a part of. And I think that is inevitable. But it does not determine what happens then. See, there's the other part of it. There's the decisions we make, the choices we make that go through it. And there's catastrophes that we fall in the history of life on Earth. There have been, you know, a bunch of times when big rocks fell out of the sky and wiped out almost everybody, you know, and then we had to start over with what was left, you know. I mean, dragons ruled the Earth for 150 million years, and we've only been here for a couple of 100,000. I mean, we can't even conceive of how long the world was ruled by them. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So
here we are. We weren't the first stringers here, you know. We're coming in to from off stage after the main act has been wiped off, you know?
Mm-hmm. Do you think the pandemic, from your point of view then, has actually been a positive in disguise?
Well, it's a purging. And, you know, one hates to say anything is positive that creates so much misery and stuff. But inevitably, diseases of any sort, just like wars and famines and other things, they take out a certain percentage of the population. And the survivors are stronger by nature, having survived. Mm-hmm. You know, what doesn't kill us makes us stronger. So we look at this as purges. If you're trying to breed livestock, you'll butcher all the ones that aren't the best ones, but the best ones you'll keep to reproduce for the next generation, and you'll keep on improving the stock. Well, nature has her own process for this, you know, and It's not something that has our best interest in mind necessarily on the immediate level, just as when the wolves take out the sick and weakly caribou, you know, they're not particularly happy about that. But the ones who survive are stronger for it, you know. Mm-hmm. So we have to look at it like that in the larger perspective. But I'm glad that I'm not involved in having to make those decisions, because it's a terrible decision to make. Mm-hmm. It happens on another level. But only a certain percentage of people who even get the any given plague die from it. Some are higher than others. In this one, it's, you know, I forget what the exact percentage is, but it's not everybody, you know. And those who don't are more resistant for the next generation and stronger for it.
That's undeniable. Yeah. So we have to start looking at it like it's a purging process.
The purging process.
The purging process to make everyone left stronger and everything better.
So everybody, that is.
Did I get that right?
Yep. That is Master Wizard over on Zell. Thank you very much for your wisdom here today. And, you know, you're coming back. It's great to see you again, spend time with you again. And nothing's changed other than your
just as enchanting and brilliant as always.
Yeah, you are. It really is. It's great. We really appreciate this. Hope you really enjoy. And everybody, check out the school. Check out more about what's going on here. There you see a real life example of one living life, how they see that they want to live life. So I think that's pretty cool. So check that, everything you need to know about Oberon there, Master Wizard Oberon at oberonzell.com. And thank you, everybody, for having us in your home. And we will see you next time.
Thank you, everybody. And together we are turning the universal key to global harmony and creating a unified world. Thank you, everybody, for tuning in. And remember, tune in often, tell all your friends, and most importantly, may all your dreams come true. Many blessings.